Yeah, I mean, I think the information coming out of Department of Defense and the White House is filled with a lot of hyperbole, but at the base of it, it's not wrong. In working on this chain library at one point, I accidentally wrote T instead of decay type T. And the result was I captured a reference instead of a value, even though the code looked like it was fine, the type was not. And that meant that I had a use after return on my stack, and it cost me half a day to debug the thing.
Hear that, folks?
The luminary, Sean
Harris, debugging his problem for half a day. There's hope for all of us.
Yeah, so it's too easy to make a mistake like that.
Welcome to ADSP, the podcast, episode 172, recorded on March 7th, 2024. My name is Connor, and today with my co-host, Bryce, we interview Sean Parent from one of the New York Adobe offices and chat about Adobe Flash, his new library and idea about function composition called chains, and his latest thoughts on memory-safe programming languages and C++.
Connor, why are we in a cab?
Turn your gain down. Testing. We're in a cab because we went to the wrong Adobe offices. We are going to interview Sean
Connor,
Parent.
What was the one job that I gave you?
Listen.
I asked Connor, hey, Connor, can you get the address of where we're going? And then we show up at the wrong building. So now we're going to have like 40 to 50 minutes to interview Sean Parent. We are currently at Broadway and 28th.
We
gotta go to 15.
Listen, folks, I'd like to clear my name here. We were at the correct Adobe office for the meetup,
and it was unclear
that Sean was going to be at a different Adobe office.
But Connor mentioned that, hey, Sean said that the office is really near his hotel.
I did.
And the office that we were going to is not near his hotel. And I said, well, maybe they have a second office in New York.
I didn't think that there was no possibility of there being a second office in New York.
But
it's
in fact,
it's New York.
Has two offices.
It's New York, of course. Yeah. I mean, literally, when I worked at Amazon, they have like six offices in Vancouver, which is like a fraction of the size. Anyways. But
should we bottom out on that reduced by key thing?
Not yet. I'm clearing my name. But my point is that I don't think it's unreasonable to assume that Sean would be at the Adobe 2 hours before the meetup happens at that building.
You're not wrong.
And oops, my bad. And that's why we're recording in the back of the cab right now.
A beautiful yellow New York City cab. Not an Uber, not a Lyft.
It is nice.
Those take forever to show up. But
it
cabs,
is nice. Yep.
You just stick your hand out. And captures it. It's wonderful.
And now we're going to go to the correct Adobe office. We got to get out of the I was going to say elevator, but it's a taxi.
It is a taxi.
I'm going to clink these microphones. We got two mics now.
Thank you, sir. You have a wonderful day.
Okay, well, same to you, brother.
Try not to forget. Thank you, sir. First ever pod recorded in a cab. Wait.
There's a possibility that we've swapped mics, which would make your editing life so much harder.
Not really, honestly.
Oh, okay, good. Then we should swap mics.
Awesome.
Thank you
so much, sir. All right, folks. We're going to the fourth floor.
Further south you go in Manhattan, the hotter the elevators get and the smaller the elevators get.
Damn.
This one's got a little small, weird door.
I don't think they have a reception. We are outside of the Adobe Union Square offices. Please check in at reception.
Where is reception? National reception, I think, was downstairs.
No, that seems to be locked.
I think we should just, did we just message Sean?
I did.
Two NVIDIA employees try to break into Adobe offices.
Weapons for, Adobe is a weapons-free workplace.
This is ADSP the Podcast, episode 172, I think.
Oh, there is Sean.
Whoa. Look at that, like magic.
Perfect timing.
Sean just popped out of the elevator.
Yeah.
This was a series of unfortunate events. We did not think that it was possible that there were two Adobe offices.
No, that's not true. We literally, I said, I didn't say that New York didn't have two. I just said, why would Sean be at a different Adobe office than the meetup? And I was wrong about that fact. You definitely were.
This was your fault, and I chose to say.
No, is it my fault? Well, I'll take the blame. You know, I'm Canadian, and I apologize on behalf of... the two Americans here.
Yeah. All right, let's.
Wait, are you not able to get into these offices either?
No.
Oh.
Good.
I was gonna say we're all locked out.
All right. Got you on the leash here.
Alrighty. This is where we steal the IP, folks.
Ooh, these are nice offices. You know, I've never been in an Adobe office that has not had nice art.
Well, I mean, it kind of is like the creative company,
I know.
You know.
Exactly.
Ooh. We'll whisper like we're in a library.
Very quiet.
What has this podcast become, folks?
Ooh, look at this thing. We can picture that.
Let's take the picture after F5, after... What we're saying, all right, we successfully snuck in to our second Adobe building. This one has Sean Parent in it. And we'll make sure we got the gains right, you know. Who knows about the audio quality of our little cab ride there. Good to have you back on the pod, Sean.
Thank you.
We were talking about room names and you were explaining.
Yeah, well, Bryce mentioned he did not, or he was seeing a pattern with the room names on this floor. And I said in San Jose, when they put in the West Tower, which is our first headquarter building, they named all the conference rooms after fonts, alphabetical, which made it very easy to find the right conference room, alphabetical by floor. And then when they put in the East Tower, somebody said, oh, I see, some of the fonts in the West Tower are named after cities. So they continued that theme, since there's fonts like New York and our East Tower, all the conference rooms are named after cities, which is very confusing, because now if you have a meeting in New York, which building are you in?
there's a font called New York?
There is a font called New York. So there are many fonts named after cities. So,
I guess fonts is not the first thing that comes to mind when I think of Adobe, but I guess it is one of the things that you do.
So we have a significant font business. And there's even a Warnock font, which is design influenced by our founder. So,
have you ever had to deal with any interesting programming problems related to fonts?
Not at Adobe. I actually worked on what became TrueType, which was Apple's and Microsoft's font system. And most of the development started at Apple, and it was part of the QuickDraw GX project. And I worked on the QuickDraw GX project. So I worked on bits of that, largely trying to optimize how you render quadratic Beziers. So Apple's font system was based off of quadratic Bezier curves, where Adobe, everything is cubic. So,
I heard a story, and I don't know if this is true, but I heard a story that on Windows, the little spinning logo is actually a font because their font system is so optimized. It's just the best way to do a little spinning logo is just a series of glyphs in the font.
I have no idea if that's true.
Yeah. All right. Well, you've got the topic.
Yeah, I do have the topic.
We don't even know if Sean has anything to say about this, but Bryce,
Bryce assured me
that the next topic, because you have questions and he better have answers. So,
well, there is something else that Adobe is known for, or was known for in the past, that we've not talked about here. Usually, I think these days we think about Adobe, we think about Photoshop, we think about generative AI. But it used to be that most people knew Adobe because of Flash. And I remember when I, back in the day, when I was a kid, all the cool websites used Flash. And Connor, didn't you, you said yesterday that you used to be an ActionScript wizard. I don't even know really what ActionScript is.
Well, ActionScript was the language that you program Flash in. And I wrote, well, a couple different applications, but one was like a pretty, it was terrible code. I didn't know what I was doing back then, but it was like a stock technical analysis program. And it was amazing because it was so fast. Like I originally wrote it in Visual Basic 6, but like drawing all those little rectangles and every single time you hit a button and it had to display everything, it just crawled to a halt. But Flash, you can just basically like redraw everything. And it's silky smooth. Like, doesn't matter how much stuff I put on screen. Anyway, so I put ActionScript 3.0 at like my expert languages at one point. But anyways, yeah.
Yeah. So did you have anything to do with Flash? Did you have any involvement with Flash?
Very little. So Flash came in when we acquired Macromedia. So it was initially a Macromedia product, and it came in through an acquisition. And when I came back to Adobe from Google, our CTO was big on Flash and decided that we were going to write all of the mobile products in Flash. And we had just started this project called Adobe Revel, which was a consumer version of Lightroom and eventually kind of morphed into Lightroom Mobile. And we did not want to code Revel in Flash. And so we had a plan, because Revel was going to largely be a tablet-based product. So it was going to be centered around the tablet. And the idea was to then feed into a Lightroom on desktop. And then Adobe had a product called Photoshop Express, which is still there in the App Store, but has very little to do with actual Photoshop. And so our thinking was to repurpose Photoshop Express, since it had kind of the camera tech and stuff, and to tailor that as the way to feed the ecosystem and get pictures into this consumer product standpoint or consumer product line. And so we had just started working with a team that was doing Express to morph it into what we needed. And when this mandate came down, we decided to sacrifice Express to get rewritten into Flash. And so that eventually got done, and then it was like a 2-year effort, and then it was scrapped.
What was it written in originally?
It was written largely in C++, so with a bit of objective C++ at the front end side.
Wouldn't it be a pretty big performance hit to rewriting nothing from C++ to Flash?
Yeah, but you know, our CTO thought that that was the way of the future, and that hardware would get faster than it would matter, was not the case. So yeah, so Express got rewritten into Flash, and it never shipped because it took them 2 years to get to feature parity to what they had 2 years ago, and it just was all around a worse experience. So that got scrapped. So we were very thankful that we didn't take Revel down that path. I had some tentative involvement with Flash during those times. And then about the time Flash was almost canceled or about to be canceled, right? For people who don't know, the reason why Flash was canceled was it just had an unbelievable stream of security issues. It was written as an old Netscape browser plugin, and so it plugged into your browser, and that was a C API, and so it was running outside of a sandbox. And one of the big reasons why people liked Flash is because it could give your website access to your operating system and your operating system capabilities. The problem with that is it gave websites access to your operating system and your operating system capabilities. So it became a big security problem, and there was a stream of exploits against it, and they got patched and patched and patched, and that kind of sucked in so many resources. It was decided that it was untenable to maintain it. There were a couple efforts to sandbox it or to rewrite it. At the time, it would have been into asm.js and Pinnacle, which were precursors to WASM. Both of those rewrites were internal, but we couldn't see a way to roll them out, because being sandboxed, they cut the capabilities off from the desktop. And so even though you would be able to run some sites in them, the main business that we had for Flash was not around games, which is how most people know Flash content, but it was around a corporate business, where corporations developed their in-house applications to be written that way. And all of those required access to the operating system. And there wasn't a way to provide that without opening up a bunch of security holes. So it got killed. This was right at the time when the first software technology lab was in the process of being nuked. And there was a point there briefly where the team got redistributed, and I ended up reporting into the Flash organization, but now it was the Flash authoring tool, which was in the middle of a big rewrite on top of HTML5. And so I got assigned to that team.
What's the name of that tool? Is it a product these days?
I think it still is. I don't even know what the name of it is now. For a while, it was just called Flash, which was very confusing because...
I can't imagine why.
Yeah. So I got assigned to that team for a little while. I spent like less than a month consulting with them, and this was when I was we were trying to figure out what was going to happen with a software technology lab. And then I had a sabbatical, and so the day before my sabbatical, I got called into a meeting, and they said, "Well, we wanted to have this straightened out before you left on sabbatical, and the decision is we're distributing the entire team all over the company." And
that's the word. It's my girlfriend. It keeps every time before vacation, her boss, like the day before vacation, boss schedules a meeting, and then it's always some bad news, and then it's just like it ruins the whole thing.
Yeah. So my sabbatical was spent looking for another job, and so I came back and resigned.
Was that when you went to Google?
That was when I went to Google. Yeah.
Have we talked about Sean's time again? We have, yeah. Because
that's the famous Rotate store.
That's where Rotate comes from. So that's the little involvement I had with Flash.
I got what I wanted out of that.
my thinking is like, makes the Flash renaming to Flash for a different product makes Microsoft Teams new teams not seem so bad, because they prefixed at least a new.
Look, we work at NVIDIA. I don't think we can give anybody shit about product naming, because ours is pretty bad.
Hey, Tesla, we named Tesla first, and then
Tesla at NVIDIA is the name of a business unit, a product, a micro architecture, and like a particular GPU SKU.
Well, in my ivory tower that I do my research in, I wasn't aware of all that. So,
it's actually my business unit is called the Tesla business unit. That's what the HPC business unit was called back in the day. Yeah. Tesla was the name of the first NVIDIA like real compute architecture back in the day.
Well, we've got halfway through the episode, and we still got 25 minutes till Sean needs to go to his next meeting. So maybe in the last 25 minutes, we might get to a couple more topics. You can give us, we are T
T-minus 25 minutes from Sean's next meeting, but T-minus 1 hour and 55 minutes from the New York C++ meetup being held at the other Adobe office, which we already have badges to, because we went there a little earlier, as you heard. You're going to be speaking. Do you want to tell us about your talk and what you're going to be talking about?
Sure. I'm going to be talking about, well, this is a kind of a draft of a talk about a draft of a library, about a half an idea. So we'll see how this goes. So I've been talking mostly with Eric Niebler about senders and receivers. I looked it up. It's more than 8 years we've been having conversations around this. And I built the STLAB concurrency library, which is mentioned in the sender receiver proposal as prior work and some inspiration there. And I've had some issues with sender receivers, and one conversation that I've had with Eric repeatedly is at the end of the day, I think senders and receivers are just a way of doing function composition. So basically all that they are you're composing a bunch of functions, which then you're going to execute, and those functions describe asynchronous or concurrent operations, and you're effectively building a program and then running the program. And it's a somewhat functional language that you're building them in. But the sender-receiver interface doesn't readily expose that. You've got, some complicated concepts that have multiple interface calls on them for setting values and setting exceptions and setting stopped and getting stop tokens. And it's this very broad interface that doesn't look like, under the hood, like just function composition. And so a couple weeks ago, literally like the day less than 2 weeks ago, I had this thought about, well, if you just took a sequence of functions and stuck them in a tuple, that you could use a fold expression to execute them flat in sequence, where the result of one feeds to the argument of the next, and could make that work. And so I wrote a little snippet of code to do that, and then I started to think, how do you go from there to building up the rest of the capabilities that you would have in sender receivers? And got pretty far and had some insights along the way. The work certainly isn't complete at this point. But it's got some interesting aspects to it, in that the structure of these things, I call them chains, it's really just a two-dimensional tuple of tuples under the hood. And that's maintained and exposed. The structure of them is very simple, but when you want to actually do something with them, you can wrap an algorithm around them that transforms that structure into a new structure and then executes that new structure. And what that means is like in senders or receivers, you would say then and hand it a lambda. And what that is in senders receivers is what is it? It's a sender adapter closure, right? So it's taking a lambda and it's capturing it in a sender, so, and adapting it to the sender interface and giving you back a new function in quotes, which is a sender that accepts a sender and returns a sender. So it's this complicated little thing. And in my model, then lambda expression is just take the lambda expression and append it to the end of the tuple. That's it. And then all the magic happens when you go to execute this, all the transformation to execute it. And I think there's some significant power in there. So I've shown that I can do transfer the execution onto other threads or other execution contexts, and I can inject in the transformation cancellation tokens and error handling. These functions are free to throw exceptions if they want to throw exceptions. All of the handling of that is handled outside and injected into the system. So that's what my talk is about, and that's the idea. And I kind of build it up from first principles, and I start with the ideas that led to me building the STLab concurrency library, and what are the problems with the STLab concurrency library, and why senders and receivers are one potential way to solve that problem. The punchline at the end is I'm not quite sure where to go from here. I've discovered some things that are broken instead of exact, and the realization that at the end of the day, this is just a, which we're building up as a functional language. We would like to prove that it's computationally complete. So I've nerd sniped the std exec authors into trying to figure out how they do that inside of std exec, and trying to fix the issues that I've raised, which are mostly around the split operation in senders receivers, which is a required operation if you want to. If you want to prove you're computationally complete. For Connor, you have to be able to implement an S combinator, and an S combinator repeats a term, and that's a split.
We love that. The starling bird. We love the starling.
Yep.
K's the kestrel.
K's the kestrel.
S is the starling.
Yep.
In this talk, it'll be, I think Adobe records them. I remember seeing, or was that when Sean Baxter was at Bloomberg? I mean, hopefully this will be recorded.
It's supposed to be recorded.
And it'll be on YouTube at some point.
I'm sure at some point Sean will probably give this talk at some other conferences too.
This is true.
Yeah.
But the eager and avid listener will want to see it as soon as possible. But we were chatting about this, was it two nights ago on Tuesday when we were at Sugarfish? And this time you explained it. Well, I think the same way, maybe slightly different details, but it made me realize that I actually, in a first edition of a different tool that I was working on at work, I did something not exactly similar, but I was trying to store views in these tuples and like the C++ 20 and 23 views. Because at one point I was trying to like lazily build these up and then just like launch them at the end, but that ran into just like massive compile time problems because the larger those things grow without actually, you know, invoking them, the slower and slower the compile times get. And because I was like automating this stuff, I was doing something super terse and then it would explode into this massive thing. So then the alternative I thought was like, what if I can just store each of these as like, you know, a slot in a tuple or whatever with of some arbitrary length. And it worked up to a certain point. But then I just ran into a mess. I'm not like a crazy template metaprogrammer, so I was probably doing some stuff wrong. But I remember like, you know, trying to store lambdas in tuples because like lambdas have unique signatures and you had to stamp out a bunch of different like and then you said you're using fold expressions, which I was not doing. Is there like a bunch of tricks that you're using to do this or
it's not much of a trick. I mean, if not in my slides, but if you've got a tuple of functions and you can call std apply to basically split those out into an argument pack. And so now you've got an argument pack of functions. And then you can take the arguments that you want to call it with, and you turn that into you capture that itself into a tuple, whatever the arguments are, and wrap that into a little struct that's got a pipe operator. And that can then feed the next function and capture the result of it as a pipeable entity. And so now you can just say, my initial argument's pipe, my argument's pipe, you know, dot, dot, dot. And you've got a fold expression that will execute the complete sequence of tuples flat.
I mean, it is a cute trick. I definitely think that would have been useful in my failed attempt to do that. And then I switched to Python and gave up on C++ and, you know, dynamic interpreted language. Woo, that's a lot easier, folks.
Yeah.
Just jit stuff on the fly.
Well, you know, I'll admit when I was starting to build the code, I got lost in the type signatures pretty quickly. And I was like, okay, I'm just going to start with make it work with an any. Right? Right. We collapse everything to an any, make it work through that, and then figure it
halfway
out.
To Python, basically.
Halfway to Python. Yep. Yep.
It's interesting because one thing that I and to some degree Connor have been working on recently has been looking at how do we parallelize range pipelines. And one of the challenges with that is that if we have like a range pipeline that has a filter somewhere inside of there, we got to go find that filter and we got to replace it with some other operation that introduces some tombstone values, and then later we remove them. And there's all sorts of other optimizations that we got to do, or we have to be able to inspect the whole pipeline. And because of the way that range pipelines are built today, which is where they're recursively, they're nested, it's a little bit harder to do this this decomposition and optimization. And, you know, if instead of being this nested structure, if they were represented as like a tuple of views or a tuple of things that were going to be applied together, it would be so much easier.
Yeah, things to be composed instead of things already composed.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, because like the – I think maybe the realization that we didn't have was that like with ranges, the reason that they come to you already composed is because there's, you know, that there was in the serial world, there's really just sort of one way of composing them. But actually, or sort of naively, there's just one way of composing them. But actually, you might want to do optimizations or transformations or compose them in a different way, you know, apply some different thing to them. And so representing them in the uncomposed form, And that gives you a lot more flexibility.
Yeah, and that's what I found is you can inject, like I said, all the structure you need. And so instead of in the sender receiver model where you're pulling through a message for what happens if there's an exception and messages for stops and things like that, that interface impacts every single level all the way through the pipeline because it all has to be composed together. If instead you say, just give me the structure, all of that information can be injected after by just transforming that structure. And when the structure is flat, it's pretty simple to do. And since these are all, you know, it's a tuple of functions, and they can be lambdas, but you could also have a type in there, which is your filter. And so now you can scan through the tuple of tuple and pull out particular types. So if you have additional information you want encoded in there, you can encode it in the type system and pull that out as part of the transformation.
I wondered too if it depends on how it was implemented, but like if you have an ability to avoid one of the worst parts of ranges, which is the errors at compile time, because I'm even as a ranges expert, and you know I'm not Tristan or Eric level, but you know I've spent quite a bit of time playing around with ranges. Every once in a while, I remember running into my first few errors. It's just like this wall, and it's like it's not wrong. It is technically the type, and it's just this nested crazy thing. You might run into the same problem, but potentially there's a opportunity to like avoid that.
Yeah, it's potential at this point. The error message that I most frequently get is tuple doesn't support the call operator. And that really means that some piece of my tuple in my fold expression is gone, and it doesn't tell me, since it's within the fold expression, right. It's like one of the 20 things you have in this pipeline is bad.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's a pain. I've got some thoughts about how to well, there's a couple things. Right now I'm building things where everything takes, you know, auto dot 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 as the args, and which means you're able to build these very generic computational patterns. But that also means when you actually call it with, you know, invoke it with 42 and something goes wrong because there's a type mismatch in the path, that you're completely lost. And so one of the things I'm playing with now is what are the trade-offs between having the developer declare the interface for the entire construct up front, so that as you append each thing, you can say, okay, if I know what the interface is, then when I append the first thing, I can see, well, will it take those arguments? And then what does it return? And when I append the next thing, I can say, will it take the thing that's returned from the previous thing? And so on. So I can type check the entire path.
Yeah, it's Connor, I think you make it's a very interesting observation there. And I think to do better, you have to not diagnose either when you're folding or once the thing is folded. Because the problem is that the folding operation, you end up with this recursive structure. And then if something bad happens down deep in the structure, then it has to roll up the stack. And even like if you don't explicitly do that, just the way that the compiler diagnostics are going to work, it's going to tell you, well, this failed here, and you know, and then this is the failure in the source, and then that was in this context, and this context, and this context, and it'll walk up the stack trace. But if you've got it as this linear chain of tuples, then you maybe have some other options where you can do some checking before you do the fold, where you just go through each pair and say, like, do these things, you know, does the first one connect to the second one? Does the second one connect to the third one? And that could, I think, give you better diagnostics and give you the more of the flat diagnostics that you'd get from just if you were writing like straight imperative code. So yeah, I think that has some real potential there to give you better diagnostics. I don't know whether it will help. The other challenge that I think a lot of people have with ranges is around compilation time. And same for senders. I don't know that this helps you there per se, because ultimately at the end of the day, you're still doing the same composition. But I think it may really help with the diagnostics. It's very interesting.
I mean, I'll link in the show notes. This has nothing to do with C++, but I saw in a talk by Jose Falim, the creator of Elixir, as they have a big pipeline. It's like not even just a library. It's the whole way the whole language works. And they showed this little demo in a Elixir live book, I think is what they call it. It's like a Jupyter notebook, but they just rebranded it. And you build up your little pipe expressions. And then if you have a problem, they just like in the notebook, you can like toggle off each one of the pipes. Like if you got a functional map or a reduction or whatever, and then like there's a little hamburger bar and you can slide them around and stuff. So I was watching this and I was like, oh my God, like when you've got a problem in C++ with ranges, it's just like, you know, a wall of template mess. Whereas over in this dynamically typed language, they're like, well, check out this little demo of debug. And like you could, as the final thing, you could pipe it to like a debug print or something, and then in the notebook it shows you at every stage like what the current, you know, value. Anyways, it was just amazing. So I'm not saying we're ever going to get to that, but there is hope out there that, you know, things can be better, that's why we have you on the show, so we can give you a bunch of work, Sean, and
you're gonna go write a C++ committee paper, of course, and give us full reference implementation. And
sure, and you know, first, now that he's got me thinking about this idea, I'm going to go write a C++ interpreter just so we can do this. That'll be a good weekend project, I'm sure.
So I got a great thing for us to close on.
All right.
So so the White House tells us no more C++. What do we think?
So does Gemini 1.5. We were talking about this the other day, too. It's C++ 20 concepts is too unsafe for anyone under the age of 18. So apologize to our younger listeners out there that are paying the $20 a month.
If you're a younger listener, please hang up now.
Yeah. what do we make of this?
We talked about this last time I was on. It's no surprise that this is coming. For corporations, I think there's going to be some amount of risk management that has to go on, and Adobe certainly in that boat. My team's on the hook for developing the roadmap, the memory safety roadmap for Adobe, and how we approach that. I had an absolutely terrifying meeting with our security team yesterday on this very topic. Yeah, I mean, I think the information coming out of Department of Defense and the White House is filled with a lot of hyperbole, but at the base of it, it's not wrong. In working on this chain library at one point, I accidentally wrote T instead of decay type T. And the result was I captured a reference instead of a value, even though the code looked like it was fine, the type was not. And that meant that I had a use after return on my stack, and it cost me half a day to debug the thing.
Hear that, folks?
The luminary. Sean Herron.
Debugging his problem for half a day. There's hope for all of us.
Yeah. So it's too easy to make a mistake like that. And a lot of times, the wrong code looks better than the right code. And that's a problem. And this was one of those cases.
There are some people that are either trying to define a safe subset of C++ or tools or things to make C++ safe, or who claim that C++ is safe. Do you buy the argument that C++ is fundamentally unsafe and that there's no hope for it? Or do you think that people and environments that care about safety can find a way to continue using languages like C++? It's just a matter of defining the rules and the guidelines to define a safe form of C++.
So I think there's like Herb Sutter's CPP2, which he states that one of his goals is not provable safety, but my team's looked at his proposals and we've given him some feedback. We actually think he's very close to being able to prove safety. He wouldn't have to compromise much to be able to do that. He doesn't seem interested in it at the moment, but maybe that will change with the current legislation. I think the work that Sean Baxter has been doing is very promising, but of course that's one guy on a non-open source project. I hope something comes out of it, if nothing more than other people steal ideas from it. We talk a lot about memory safety in the abstract, both without a clear definition of memory safety is and losing sight of what the goals of the memory safety are. And safety properties in general are tools to help prove correctness of code. And, to prove partial correctness of an application, you have to demonstrate that it satisfies a set of safety properties, and memory safety being one of those. But the goal from a security standpoint is something called a non-interference property, which is both a safety and liveness property, and the memory safety is just in support of non-interference. And the basic idea with non-interference is that a defect in one piece of your code should not affect another piece of your code. It should limit the blast radius. So when you're really talking about non-interference properties, things like shared pointers become a problem. Any shared mutable state becomes a problem. Sharing indices to the same array is another way to share information becomes a problem. Right, so even if you're outside of the pointer space, and C++ doesn't give you any tools to help you build code that satisfies a non-interference property. Even if you could go through with C++ and you could say every place where it's undefined behavior, I'm going to insert a runtime check, and ta-da, C++ is completely safe. Your program will probably never terminate because it will run so slow, but it will be very safe. So at one end, that's completely doable. And then the next end is how much performance can you get back through optimization, knowing that some of these checks are unnecessary? And then how do you structure your code to guarantee that those optimizations kick in? And what are the guidelines for that? But then you're still left with a piece of code that looks like a piece of C++ code and probably needs a redesign. And when they're talking about memory safety, it's 70% of the exploitable CVEs, according to Microsoft and Google, that they see. Well, that leaves another 30% of the problem. So even if we fixed all the memory safety problems, we wouldn't have like super bulletproof software. It's like your ship's going down, it's got three holes in it, and you're like, well, we got a way to patch two of them.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, and also if everybody's programming memory safe languages, then attackers will spur innovation and new ways of attacking software. There will always be attacks.
Yeah, there will always be attacks. So I think eventually the changes have to be, much deeper and much more radical than just shoring up C++.
Yeah.
You know, that said, like Photoshop alone has 30 million lines of C++ code, and it's not going away anytime soon.
How long did you say that that flash rewrite took? 2 years. How many lines was that? Probably, you know, like
I don't know, maybe 500,000 tops.
All right, so that's like a factor of 30 million carried. I think it's just two, so it's like 4 years is all you need.
Yeah, good math there.
We should probably let Sean go because he's got another meeting.
Yeah. This is true. We have made you late.
You've been hearing my watch buzz.
Be sure to check the show notes either in your podcast app or at adspthepodcast.com for links to anything we mentioned in today's episode, as well as a link to a GitHub discussion where you can leave thoughts, comments, and questions. Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed and have a great day.
Low quality, high quantity. That is the tagline of our podcast.
It's not the tagline. Our tagline is chaos with sprinkles of information.